Welcome. You are listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, and this is Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove. While it's always better to hear it live, this is a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. Enjoy our latest installment. Shabbat Shalom. As a vested stakeholder in the condition of diaspora Jewry, of late I keep returning to the purported Chinese curse, "May you live in interesting times." On the one hand, our present moment is without precedent. We live with blessings of which our predecessors could only dream. Our problems are the challenges of intermarriage, negotiating our hyphenated identities, high-class problems resultant of our warm acceptance in the diaspora. And yet, beneath the veneer of our security, our insecurities are rendered evident. Not yet 6 months passed since the Pittsburgh Tree of Life Synagogue massacre, a shooting motivated by homegrown right-wing nationalisms. 2 weeks ago, Argentina's chief rabbi, brutally beaten in his home. Last week, a carnival float in Belgium featuring a huge puppet of hook-nosed grinning Jews, a rat, and money bags. Israel, home to half of world Jewry, doesn't lack for enemies. In the run-up to Israel's election, we're witnessing the rise of a nationalist sentiment by way of political coalitions between the Netanyahu government and Otzma Yehudit, heirs to Mayor Kahani's Kach, a racist, violent, and outlawed political party, marginalized no longer. It's a development that further tears at the bond between Israel and a historically left-leaning American Jewry, who themselves are contending with an emboldened and militant left that cunningly has blurred the line, Corbyn-like, between being anti-Israel and anti-Jewish. Vile suggestions of dual loyalty as they crouch behind the flag of free speech. Just think how surreal our world has become when yesterday, President Trump, a man who has enabled some of the most unseemly hatreds in America to bloom, who himself, in speaking to American Jews, referred to Israel as your country, can call out the Democratic Party as anti-Jewish. Just think about that fact. Not just in Washington, but in our own backyard, literally. Yesterday, I was in touch with the leadership of Asphalt Green on 91st Street, where my children, and probably your children, have grown up playing sports, vandals painting swastikas in their locker room. A Jewish community as strong as ours, and then anti-Semitic graffiti, understandably putting us on high alert. Security coupled with deep insecurity. Our fears of assimilation alongside charges of dual loyalty, our embrace of Jewish power coupled with fears of its abuse. Our time, to say the least, is an interesting one, a blessing and a curse, something for everyone. This morning, I want to take a crack at untangling some of the knottier issues of our moment, not so much by offering any solutions, but by providing the thing so often missing from the rapid-fire news cycle and our clipped attention spans, and that is context, historical context. You may think that the greatest threat to the Jewish community comes from the left. You may think it comes from the right. You may believe that our existential challenge is assimilation. You may think it's anti-Semitism. There are a lot of things you may think and I may think, but the first step strikes me as asking the most basic question of how did we get here in the first place? Why do we respond the way we do? How has such a small people allowed itself to be subdivided and at odds with each other? These are questions I want to approach this week, possibly next week too, and I want to do it by way of two texts, one ancient and relatively well-known, the Book of Esther, and one recent and relatively unknown, an essay on American Jewry by my friend and Dartmouth scholar, Dr. Shaul Magid. Yesterday, as I mentioned to the B'nai Mitzvah, we announced the new month of Adar, and with it, the countdown to the festival of Purim and the reading of the scroll of Esther. The immediacy of the book of Esther is no doubt due to it being a tale containing eerie parallels to our own time. What is Esther about, if not a Jewish community that lives comfortably at a distance from the Jewish homeland and is subjected to the charge of dual loyalty? There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the other peoples of your realm, announces the wicked Haman to King Ahasuerus. Their laws are different, and it's not in your majesty's interest to tolerate them, he says. I have no idea if Haman's politics lean left or right, but I do know that he knew how to stoke the latent anti-Semitism for his own gain. Neither in the time of Esther nor our own is it totally clear how this mercurial figurehead at the top, with Jewish family members of his own, actually feels about Jews. The well-being of the Jews never seems personal, but secondary to questions of political expediency and survival. But for the Jews of Shushan, their near destruction is altogether personal. Having stared at the face of their own destruction, the final half of the book of Esther can be read as a meditation on responses to trauma, how the diaspora community responded to their near destruction. And here is where the lesser-known thinking of Professor Magid comes into play. For Magid, in order to understand the last 70 years of American Jewish life, one must appreciate the perfect storm of forces that have shaped our existence. We are, on the one hand, a deeply scarred community. Not only did the Holocaust wipe out 6 million of our brothers and sisters, but it left the surviving Jewish community traumatized by this cataclysmic loss. Anti-Semitism, of course, long preceded the Holocaust, but the Holocaust was a savage exclamation point to a long history of anti-Jewish persecution and the forlorn hope of Jewish acceptance in a non-Jewish world. We are all, knowingly or not, post-Holocaust Jews. And yet, and this is equally important, the story of American Jewry these last 70 years has not just been response to catastrophe. These decades have borne witness to unprecedented social acceptance, upward social mobility, the acquisition of Jewish power. The exceptionalism of the last 70 years is due not just to the establishment of the State of Israel. The exceptionalism of the last 70 years is due to the fact that we are, no different than in the story of Esther, a post-traumatic community whose diaspora existence, ironically, is playing out in circumstances as comfortable and secure as any Jewish community has ever known. And here is where it gets interesting, because both in Esther's time and our own time, we can identify at least 4 primary responses, which I will label, number 1, the never again universal instinct, number 2, the never again tribal instinct, number 3, the Jewish establishment instinct, and number 4, the Jewish renewal instinct. Category 1, never again universal. This group reflects those people and institutions who, in recognizing the horror of the Holocaust and the unprecedented blessings of American Jewish life, have chosen to universalize its message. Never again can we let the trauma that befell the Jewish people befall any people. The intolerances that led to hatreds, that led to persecutions in Darfur, in Rwanda, in inner cities, in the work of so many progressive causes. No different than the commandment to know the heart of the stranger, for we were once strangers in Egypt, much in the same way that Hias used to take refugees because they were Jewish, but now does so because we are Jewish, much in the same way that Queen Esther's final ordinance calls for universal shalom ve'emet, equity and honesty. Given the blessings of American Jewry, given an awareness of post-Holocaust, we must commit to never again against any member of humanity. Category number 2, never again the tribal version. This group or sentiment stands in stark opposition to the first group, who believe that the universal, that this universal liberalism of American Jewry is delusional. If nothing else, the Holocaust proved the inability of the non-Jew to countenance the presence of the Jew in its midst. In every generation, as the Passover Haggadah teaches, they will come to destroy us, and God will save us from their hands. This never again is a form of Jewish self-defense that has many forms: Entebbe, Osirik, the saving of Soviet Jewry, the thesis being that the take-home message of the Holocaust is that Jews must take their defense into their own hands. It found its sharpest and a legal expression in the aforementioned Meir Kahane, the godfather of post-Holocaust militancy, whose book was actually called Never Again, in which he argued that Jews must refuse to wallow in the delusional house slave self-hatreds of liberal politics. It is a sentiment altogether present in the Book of Esther, where the fear of the Jew falls on Persia as the Jews attack those who would seek to hurt them. A tribal sentiment of self-defense that explicitly or not, legally or not, serves to explain some of what we are witnessing on the scene today. Category 3, the Jewish establishment. If there is one lesson that Esther and Mordechai take away from their threat of Haman, is the obligation to be engaged at the highest reaches of power to ensure our people's survival. We need to create the ADLs, the APACs, the AJCs, the JCRCs, the JDCs, the UJAs, the Conference of Presidents, the alphabet soup of American Jewish life, which at the most basic level are the civic organizations of Jewish survival. Their purpose, and this isn't a criticism, next week together with many congregants I'll be at the APAC conference, is not about Jewish content, it's about Jewish survival. Once again, for the most part, these organizations existed prior to the Holocaust, but the combination of the trauma of the Holocaust and a deep-seated guilt that American Jewry could have done more to save European Jewry, together with our newfound strength in post-war America, serves to give rise to the Jewish establishment as we know it today. And finally, category number 4, which I will call Jewish renewal. The Nazis murdered 6 million Jews, wiping out entire worlds of secular, religious, cultural, and intellectual Jewish life. In the wake of such horror, some Jews, for good reason, turned their back on Judaism. But many, thankfully, did just the opposite, doubling down on Jewish renewal. Think about the rise of Chabad in our time, the rise of the Jewish renewal movement under the leadership of Reb Zalman and Rabbi Waskow, the musical creations of Shlomo Karlebach, the JCC movement, the intellectual legacies of Heschel, Soloveitchik, Borowitz, and others, the establishment of Jewish studies programs across the country, the Jewish camping movement, the rise of the Lakewood Yeshiva from a few hundred to tens of thousands and growing. Think about the daily labors of synagogues of all denominations, this one included. Our tactics may differ, and we operate in different spheres of the Jewish world, but at the end of the day, we're all just doing our level best to create the most vibrant expression of Jewish life for Jews of our time. Orthodox, conservative, reform, secular, academic, we're all after the same thing: leveraging the freedoms of American Jewry with an aim to leave this world with more committed Jews than when we entered it. It's worth noting that in Jewish legal literature, the significance of the Book of Esther is that it marks when Jews took on their Jewishness, kiblu vekimu, with a full and willing heart. We will never understand the absolute evil of Nazism, nor the thinking of a God in whose world 6 million Jews could be killed. But what we can do is create a Jewish future so bright that the next generation cannot help but opt into Jewish living and community of deep meaning. 4 responses of diaspora Jewry in the wake of the Shoah, the Holocaust: the universal, the tribal, the establishment, and the renewal. There's some overlap, they're not mutually exclusive, and it goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, it's a discussion that's not complete without mention of Jewish memory and of Israel. The establishment of Holocaust memorials in D.C. and Battery Park, on the calendar and history departments and otherwise, are part of this story. So too, any discussion of post-Holocaust Jewry must take into account the most significant game changer of the past 2,000 years of Jewish history, the establishment of a sovereign Jewish state. There are probably other responses to tragedy too. Indeed, if there is one thing I have learned as a pastor, is that there are as many different kinds of responses to trauma as there are, well, people who have suffered trauma, which is ultimately the point of my remarks today. If one believes that the arms of American Jewry may be understood as varied responses to the Holocaust, then one begins to understand the complexities of our present moment. Our nerves are exposed and raw. An extended collective consciousness of the Jewish people of PTSD, and whatever our blessings may be, anti-Semitism continues to evoke a heightened and varied response. There will be those universalists who understand contemporary anti-Semitism in the context of other hatreds, and the Jewish state of all states should know better than to impede the rights of the minority in their midst. There will be those tribalists who reject such liberal self-delusions, who believe that it's just a matter of time when the shoe drops again, and that any criticism of Israel or Jews is just the latest incarnation of the most ancient hatred. There's a Jewish establishment who believe that we best forward our interests through the mechanisms of civic engagement, fighting the fight in the public square. And then finally, there are those Jews like me who, while understanding and often supporting those engaged in these aforementioned efforts, have chosen to spend my life bringing Jews closer to Jews and their Judaism. All four have their place, all four worthy of mine and your support, all four responding to the challenges of our present day moment. Have we solved anything? I'm not so sure. But maybe, just maybe, we have a way and a language to understand why we feel and react the way we do to anti-Semitism, why others feel differently than we do, and the outline of a pathway of how to be in dialogue and work constructively towards addressing some of the most vexing issues of our age. LaYehudim hayta ora v'simcha v'sason v'ikar. The Jews should enjoy light and gladness, happiness and honor. The hope of Purim is a promise that the Jewish people should live at peace with their neighbors, comfortable in their own skin, comfortable amongst a non-Jewish world, enjoying light, gladness, happiness, and honor. It is a day not yet upon us. It is a day to which we nevertheless work towards. May we all live to rejoice in its arrival. Shabbat Shalom. Thank you for listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. See you in shul. Hallelujah. Hallelujah. Hallelujah.